Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is being brought to you by our friends at the Expert Institute. Expert Institute is a company that assists trial lawyers in finding the right experts for your case and in helping you prepare your case for settlement or for trial. The way they do that is in a number of services that they offer. One is that if you need an expert in a case, a specific expert from a particular specialty or geographic location, they will go out and perform a search for that expert and a unique search for every case for each expert. So you're not using the same tired old experts who testify in case after case. They're actually going out and finding new people to serve as experts in your case. They've found me some really great experts in areas that are often really hard for me to find on my own, places where I've struck out in the past and found experts that didn't perform well, areas such as orthopedic surgery, neurointensive care. I even had them find me an expert in a case involving security at a convenience store. So they can locate experts in all different types of cases, whether it's personal injury, product liability, medical malpractice. The other great part about Expert Institute is if you're looking for an expert in a case, they'll often give you several options so that you can meet and interview multiple possible experts and choose the best one. So you're not just backed into using the whatever expert is most convenient or just happens to be available. It's actually a robust process where you're finding the best person for the job. And that adds significant value in cases. So if you're interested in working with Expert Institute, I would encourage you to give them a call or check them out online. If you search for them at expertinstitute.com/elevate, you can get a 25% off discount on your first expert consultation. Our show today is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a case management system. I wanted to say software, but it's really more than software these days because they offer a full cloud-based integration, so you don't really need software. It's all available for you. Everything is stored and processed through the cloud. They have a server-based application as well, but it seems like more and more folks are moving more toward cloud-based programs, which is the way we use it. It's a fantastic program to the point where I was meeting with one of my paralegals the other day, and she exclaimed, "Ben, the best decision you made since opening this new law firm was getting Smart Advocate. It's awesome." And it's really great to hear that from my staff and the people who have to do the really hard work of managing a volume of cases, intakes, and discovery all the way up through trial. So we've had a great result with Trial Advocate. It's a very powerful and robust program. I know it's used by firms that do multi-district litigation and class action and literally have tens of thousands of clients all the way down to smaller PI firms. It can be customized for each particular application. In our case, where we do a lot of medical malpractice cases and have very record and document intensive cases, it's also worked well for that. We can text and email our clients right through the interface. It automatically saves all of that correspondence so we can see what's happening, and it's really worked well for us. So I encourage you to contact Smart Advocate if you're looking for case management software and check it out. Our show today is also sponsored by our friends at Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full-service digital marketing firm for trial lawyers. Micah and Tyler at Hype Legal had worked at High Impact, which is a trial animation and graphics firm, for a collective 20-plus years. So they're very familiar with trial lawyers and what we do. And now they're taking the skill set that they developed there in high-end graphics and aesthetics and putting that to use for legal marketing. If you go to their website at hypelegal.com, you can check out a number of law firm websites and digital marketing campaigns that they've created, including the graphics and the website for our podcast, which is really terrific. So I encourage you to check out hypelegal.com.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Hi, this is Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Rahul. As you know, I'm heading off to Hawaii on Saturday, so I'm counting down the days and really excited for the trip.
And then how many days are you going to be there?
Just a week. You know, it's all for work, as you know, so I won't be having any fun. And I am dragging my whole family with me, though. My wife and three children are coming, so they're really excited about it. Although Maine is beautiful in the summer, it's, you know, this is like the time of year you want to be in Maine, so it's always a little hard to leave, but we're excited for it. How about you?
We're headed to Spain tomorrow, despite the Delta variant. We booked the flights before everything started to get a little bit more precarious. So fortunately, my wife and kids were all vaccinated and hoping for an eventful trip, but not eventful because of the coronavirus. Ben, we've got Paul Graywall here, and I know you're not heavily invested in cryptocurrencies, maybe not at all, but he's, you know, a federal district court judge turned Facebook turned Coinbase. Just watching his career trajectory is something that I only wish I could emulate, but the ship has already sailed for me on that. But I'm excited to meet you, Paul. Hey, and be with you again, Paul. Good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to see you, Rahul. Ben, it's great to meet you. I'm excited to do this. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I just touched upon it a little bit, but like usual in our podcast, I am by far the least qualified person to be on here. Ben, Cornell and Yale, you, MIT and University of Chicago, me, Harvard of the West at UC Riverside. So I always love learning from amazing lawyers and people who've done such innovative things. And I'm really excited to learn a little bit about how you became who you are today. And one of the questions I had, just to kind of tee it off, we talk a little bit about how it is to be a trial lawyer and the life of a trial lawyer. Before taking the bench, you were that. You were a trial lawyer trying cases all over the country.
It was, yeah.
So what about that? How did you get good at becoming a trial lawyer? And then my more important follow-up question is, what skill sets translated into your subsequent careers?
I will leave it to the jurors I appeared before and the judges as well to assess whether I was any good at it. But, you know, when I was starting out as a young associate in a major firm and a major practice, one of the things I tried to do in addition to my work in 6-minute increments like everybody else was to really study some of the great trial lawyers I was working with and against and try to figure out how did they become that good and deconstruct it and sort of start with the end product and work backwards from there. And, you know, that process shed light on, you know, a lot of classic skills that most of us understand, you know, make up the great trial lawyers, right? An incredible ability to be succinct, and an incredible ability to take really complicated concepts and break them down into discrete elements that anyone not only could understand, but could get excited about. There's the great writing that I think often goes undersold in becoming a great trial lawyer, given how important briefing is in any actual trial. So, you know, I did a lot of sort of self-study of the masters around me to really understand what I needed to become and where I needed to aim for if I ever wanted to be anywhere near, you know, their class in terms of my capacity in the courtroom. And then I went about it and I, you know, aggressively went after every little opportunity I had to be on my feet, especially in a courtroom in front of a judge or a jury, even if I knew almost nothing or absolutely nothing about the subject matter, even if, you know, the partner I might be working for or the client that we were both serving might've been better off with somebody else. I just felt like it was that important to grab every opportunity I could and then hold myself accountable for meeting or exceeding the standards and expectations of the people who gave me that opportunity. And you know, from there, things went forward.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about that era? What kind of firm were you working for and what kind of cases were you involved in trying?
Yeah, so I came out of law school in the mid-90s and like a lot of new lawyers interested in a litigation and trial law practice, I thought, what better way to to get some insight into how that worked than to go clerk for a judge or two, which is what I ended up doing. And after, you know, clerking in federal district court and on the Court of Appeals, you know, I went into practice initially at a large law firm, at the Pillsbury firm in San Francisco. But then I spent really the heart of my career in practice at a little boutique called Day Case Beer in Cupertino, California, that was formed by a number of former Cooley Goddard senior partners who really wanted to strike out on their own and focus on this niche that in the mid-90s seemed kind of esoteric, which was trying technology cases to juries. And as it turned out, I happened to be in the right place at the right time, because at that point in the history of practice, you know, the technology trial really came into its own. And so I found myself working on some of the biggest cases of the day. In Microsoft antitrust litigation, my firm played some significant part in those cases. Did a lot of patent and other IP litigation work for big tech companies like Qualcomm and Symantec and Amgen. And so I really just found myself in the right place at the right time, with not just a background that lent itself to that kind of work, but a real appetite for wanting to learn, how do you explain this complicated stuff to people who have no background and all too often have no real interest either, and motivate them to understand what the right issue was, and then obviously your view or your client's view of the right solution to the problem presented. And so that's how I went about it.
So without getting into too much granularity, what did you learn about how to communicate these very complex issues and maybe potentially uninteresting issues to a jury?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as fascinating as I used to find the design of a microprocessor or the composition of a erythropoietin compound, most jurors did not, and most judges did not. What I came to understand early on was that argument by analogy was critical. That even if somebody couldn't, be on a very superficial level, even understand the language or the concept you were speaking, if you could offer them an alternative framework, a model that allowed them to comfortably engage with the subject matter, you had a chance. And it wasn't just about persuading them of the righteousness of your argument or positional. That's obviously the end game. What I found in advocacy, especially in technology cases, was that that branch you offered to the juror or judge by providing an analogy or an alternate framework was really an offer of generosity, right? It was, let me meet you where you are, and let me not try to talk down to you. Let me try to show you how smart I am by using lots of fancy vocabulary. Let me actually give you the tools so that when you walk out of this process, whether it's a 1-hour hearing or a 3-month trial, you'll feel not only smarter and better about yourself as a result, but you'll feel proud of the service that you've done in helping these two or more parties get to a resolution of a problem they couldn't solve for themselves. That was the mindset that I had when I approached it. And it served me well, not just as a newer lawyer, but throughout my career.
In those cases where you had complex technology issues, what do you think drove juror decisions? Do you think that by the end of the case, and I imagine some of those trials went on quite long, that they really did understand the science? Or do you think that there were more accessible themes that kind of transcended that drove decision-making? And do you think they often would get it right in terms of the science?
Yeah. So my perspective, Ben, on this was really forged in two parts of my career. You know, initially as a law clerk to a federal district judge doing a lot of trials, I got a glimpse of how juries thought, because, you know, you're sitting there in chambers every day. You're working on jury instructions with the district judge. You're fetching donuts for the jury when nobody else thought to get them something to eat at a break, and everything in between. And so through that process, you started to get familiar and frankly comfortable just being around jurors, which was something that I really came to enjoy. And then as a U.S. magistrate judge myself, I had the pleasure of trying a lot of cases with juries. And one of the privileges you have as a judge is after the trial is you can go into the jury room and literally ask them, what was persuasive? Why did this witness seem to capture your attention when the other witnesses did not? what five documents mattered to you in reaching your decision. And so that really gave me an informed view that I felt like, you know, I had been looking for, you know, throughout my career up until that point. And among the lessons that I learned was that, number one, very few jurors in technology intensive cases, like the kind I used to handle, truly understand the science beyond a superficial level. I think we are deluding ourselves in thinking that a 1 week or 1 month or even 1 year trial truly can educate people to, you know, through no fault of their own. They didn't volunteer for jury duty. Let's remember that, right? They are compelled to appear by force of the United States Marshals if necessary. But to embrace, you know, basic concepts and try to understand how things work, I think that, you know, what they really are trying to do is two things. One, acquire enough of the fundamental concepts and vocabulary in order to have an intelligent conversation, not with you or with the experts, but among themselves about what was right and what was wrong. And then the other thing I really came to appreciate talking to jury after jury in these cases was that the facts and the science that we were presenting, either as trial lawyers or as a judge, in which case I was trying to, you know, master the ceremony of the presentations presented by others, these facts were being put into narratives that they were creating in order to assess essentially who was in the right and who was in the wrong. How does the morality play that they are witnessing take place before them orient and organize all these disparate concepts in ways that resonate or in ways that can make them feel comfortable and confident that even if they can't explain the biology, you know, that's being debated in the courtroom in a particular case, they can feel good that they reached the right decision. And that's really, as much as anything, what I learned from all those different experiences.
So as a sitting federal district court judge, how many trials did you preside over?
You know, I used to know this number by heart, and any judge who says they can't tell you how many trials they've done, jury trials especially, I would question. My old pals on the bench all used to keep score in some form or fashion. For me, I think I probably in 5 or so years on the district court, I tried something like 30 some cases to verdict, jury verdict, and then a bunch of bench trials on top of that.
In watching that, whether it's bench trials or jury trials, was there a particular type of method of advocacy that you found to be effective for you as the trier fact or in observing the jurors?
So I think that every trial lawyer, whether she's been doing it for a month or for 30 years, has a unique style. And speaking for myself, early on, I felt obligated to try to mimic or copy the styles of these masters I kept telling you. I mentioned to you earlier, right, that I used to study over and over again. And the real breakthrough moment for me, and I'm not even sure when this happened, when I realized that the style itself was less important. The authenticity of the style was what mattered. Right. And so whether yours was a sweet and endearing style, whether yours is a more aggressive and authoritative style, whether your affect was joy, whether your affect is indignation, right? Whatever your approach to presenting your personality to the jury, authenticity was everything. And I felt like as the judge watching the proceedings day in and day out, especially sitting literally on high, right? But also I knew this from my conversations, the jury felt the same way. You could tell who was playing a part in some play they constructed in their head and who was truly just being themselves. Now, you know, presentation matters. And so we all tend to embellish certain elements of the presentation style. But you could tell who was being true to their form and who was addressing the jury or the judge in a manner that was entirely consistent with how they would speak to a friend or a colleague or a neighbor. And that's really the attribute I found to be the most critical for connection between trier and decider.
How important do you think the quality of the lawyering is to the outcome from your experience as a judge? We like to think we have lots of control over that as lawyers, but we all know of anecdotes or experiences where you really outtry the case against opposing counsel, or you watch a trial where one lawyer is clearly doing a much better job, but they still don't prevail. So what was your experience with that?
Yeah, one of the things that I learned over and over again was, as between the best trial lawyer in the courtroom and the best set of facts, I'll take the best set of facts every time. You just can't be good facts. You know, if you've got the defendant on tape confessing to selling the drugs and the dope is on the table in the camera shot, I'm going to take that over a superior trial performance any day. But I do think that great lawyering does matter. I don't want to suggest otherwise. And I think that where I saw it play out more than anything else was in the shot selection that every great trial lawyer has to undergo 1,000 times in any court day, right? Not only what witnesses in what order, talking about what subjects, but what documents and what portions of documents and what ordering of the points that a document might reveal is so critical to building a sense of confidence in the jury or judge that as between these two very different explanations for what happened in a particular case, this is the side that feels most natural, that resonates most with how I would want to think about these facts if I were witnessing them myself in the first instance. And I think that's where the great lawyering comes in. It's in shot selection. I also think the great lawyers that I saw were just as careful about what issues to let go of as what issues to focus on, right? So whether it was in a closing argument, whether it was in a cross-examination, I saw so many instances of otherwise very solid performances go south by the lawyer trying to take on too much, too fast, too often, right? And the great ones really could understand that even if they didn't get to points 7, 8, or 9, if they nailed points 1, 2, and 3, they were done. And they could comfortably and confidently rest at that point. That was something done right that I just never got tired of watching, because it was really like seeing an artist, you know, performing at the highest level.
So how did your experience on the bench, let me ask it a different way. I'm still trying to figure out that interview with Facebook. So you leave the bench and talk about an amazing landing that you had. I don't know if that was before you left the bench or right after, but what were the issues that you needed to talk to Facebook about where they said, we want this guy to be VP, deputy GC, handling basically all of our litigation around the world?
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't say for certain what was in anyone's mind at Facebook when they decided to talk to me, let alone hire me. But I can say that from my perspective, the things that ultimately proved to be most valuable for me in that role running global litigation were just the lessons I learned on the bench and the confidence I built that I could handle new issues and new disputes, even if I hadn't had any experience with them. You know, as a judge in federal district court, one of the luxuries that you have is that you are exposed to every kind of case involving every kind of party on every kind of day. And so, you know, you would bounce from 8 to 9 to 10 to noon to 2 to 3 and touch patents in 1 hour, civil rights issues the next, federal criminal law after that, and then close it out with some securities, you know, cases or whatever or products liability issues. And so that comfort and confidence addressing a wide portfolio of cases, as it turned out, was like the perfect training for me to walk into Facebook in 2016 and suddenly find myself responsible for, you know, that company's entire global docket. The other thing I think that judging taught me more than anything else was how to connect not just with other lawyers or other judges, but with other kinds of people on any given day. You know, I would have the lions of the trial bar in my courtroom one moment, and the next moment I would be dealing with victims and family members in a federal criminal case that no one else would care about. I would talk to jurors. I would talk to federal agents who would come into my chambers looking for search warrants. I would meet with pretrial services officers who would want to talk about a pretrial violation and the family circumstances of the defendant that might have been relevant to assessing their danger to the community or the risk of flight. So you are exposed to a huge mix of legal topics, yes, but you are also exposed to a huge mix of people. And, you know, I don't want to speak for Facebook, but I would think that for a platform serving now several billion people around the world, having some experience dealing with that range of personality, people type, as well as legal type, was of some value. And so, you know, it turned out to be pretty helpful training, as it were.
So obviously Facebook has been in the news a lot recently because of the claims that it facilitates spreading of misinformation and propaganda surrounding the coronavirus and other things. That seems like it would go part and parcel with any platform where you've got millions of people communicating in a, you know, an open fashion. But I'm just curious what your thoughts are about where we're heading with all that. I mean, we're looking at more government regulation of that kind of digital medium, or is it going to somehow self-regulate? And, you know, what are the implications of kind of where we're heading with all that?
Well, I think the opportunity for self-regulation has long since passed. You know, Ben, I joined Facebook in the summer of 2016, and it seems like ancient history, at least to me. But if you think back on that moment for just a second, it was really the last days in which social media and big tech in general could do no wrong, right? The issue was, the debates we were having was, is Facebook and other companies in tech merely a force for good or a force for great? You know, there was just nothing that the company could do that was wrong in the eyes of an adoring public. And policymakers and government officials were at the front of that line, you know, singing Facebook's praises. I had about 8 weeks of that, and then the fall election hit in 2016, and all the allegations and concerns about Russian activity on the platform quickly engulfed the company. You know, shortly after that, you know, it was Cambridge Analytica and all of the issues regarding user privacy that, you know, swarmed over that company and continued to dog it, I think, to this day. And everything else that you've read in the newspaper. So I really got to sort of see how, on a dime, that very, you know, positive, can't do wrong reputation can, you know, turn. Even as, you know, Facebook had issues going back to the earliest days of the company. But that was really an experience unlike anything else I had ever been a part of. And so, do I think that, you know, there's more regulation coming? Absolutely. I think you just have to sort of study what Congress is up to, what the president and his economic working group recently announced, to see and to consider the, you know, recent appointments in key positions in the government over the last 6 months, to see that there's a very different attitude towards tech today. And, you know, a lot of that, frankly, is deserved. There's no question in my mind that many social media companies, not just Facebook, made a lot of really poor decisions about how products should be designed, how to disclose and be transparent with users about how their privacy would be managed, all of that. There were just some dumb decisions that were made. And so it's not surprising to me that regulators and policymakers would say, you know what, it may be way past due, but we're going to do something about this. Now, you know, I'm still hopeful that we'll strike the right balance, because I remain convinced, even if it's not a popular position, that these companies have overwhelmingly been a force for good in the world, even if they've made some really terrible decisions that have hurt a lot of people in very real ways. And so, you know, I think this is where we have to have faith that our democracy will sort it all out, even if, you know, many of us don't have a lot of faith in our democratic institutions in the way that we did maybe a decade or two decades or three decades ago.
And can I just, sorry, Ro, if you want to jump
in. No, please.
Just because you have this very unique experience going from being an advocate in a courtroom and trusting a process that depends on people coming in with open minds to make decisions about important matters, to working for a company that has enormous influence over the very minds of those same people that someday will be sitting in a courtroom. And that's something we struggle with as trial lawyers, because it's no longer the case that people show up in a courtroom, maybe it never has been, really without lots of preconditioning on almost all of the important issues that make me. So how do you have a system that was designed, you know, under the old British common law and imported here, you know, a couple hundred years ago, when we didn't have this kind of digital media, ubiquitous propaganda or communication, and to use a non loaded term. How do you fit that into our old jury model and make that actually work?
Well, it's funny, right? So like the most ancient and common depiction of Lady Justice, right, is wearing a blindfold. And I think that we've always romanticized this notion of pure, pristine jurors and judges coming unadulterated to a set of facts and applying well-defined standards to a given record to reach a fair and just outcome. Now, I think history is super important. I think if you go back and read Common Sense by Thomas Paine, if you go back and read the Federalist Papers, if you go back and if you want to go back even further and read Blackstone, right? There was never a time in which society was not at each other's throats in some form or fashion in the public square. And so that continued, for 200 plus years. When I was a kid and as I became an adult, the most common medium for this type of exchange was talk radio and then cable news. And so, now we have come to the present day in which you have even more powerful technologies supporting this type of vitriol, among our citizenry and forming impressions of parties and issues well before, they get presented in a court of law. I totally accept that the power of these new technologies dwarfs, the broadsheets of 1790 or whatever. But I do think that our system still holds and still works. And I am somebody who has sat on both sides of that bar. I'm now a client and have been a client in that same set of proceedings. And I continue to believe that even if, in any given case, there's a risk of injustice, by and large, our system still works, in large part because I believe in the jury system. I believe that when people take an oath to serve as jurors, they take that oath seriously. I can count on one hand the number of times in impaneling over 30-some juries that a juror seem to be casual or cavalier about what we were asking them to take on as a responsibility. Over and over again, I used to see billionaires, because I sat in the courthouse in Silicon Valley. We had a number of them sitting next to bus drivers who might have, not had, more than $20 to their name, working together to solve another citizen's or set of citizens' problems. And that's what juries are there to do, right? And I got inspired by that. And, I've lost cases in the courtroom and that has frustrated me. And I've had to explain to my clients why we lost and why they were going to have to do something they didn't want to do. But that never dimmed or diminished my faith that people take their responsibilities seriously. Now, on the issue of how do we adjust to this onslaught of information that jurors are exposed to even before, and in some cases during, their jury service, I think that we have to be realistic about that and accept that they are being hit and bombarded with messages that may be contrary to this idealistic notion of justice as being blind. What I think we should not do is attempt to turn back the clock in some ways, or look only for those jurors who are truly pristine and according to some definition, because I don't think they exist. But I don't think that that's a problem, because I think that even those people who have been exposed to ideas or issues can render a neutral and just outcome if we give them the tools to do that. And we can talk about some ideas for that I have, but I think it's really important to appreciate how hard jurors generally work to get it right.
Well, I want to hear your ideas on tools to do exactly that. Piqued my interest.
Yeah, well, let me offer a couple, Rahul. One is, and this is not like original to me. I don't claim any credit for this, but let's start with voir dire. Okay, at least in my part of the world, in my part of California, it has traditionally been the case that the judge handles 90%+ of the voir dire, and I think that is the emerging trend. Even in those parts of the country, they had a very different approach traditionally. I never understood that. I never understood why the trial lawyers were not largely responsible and in charge of that process, with the judge keeping the guardrails in place, making sure nobody went out of, went completely haywire or out of hand. And the reason why I felt so strongly that the trial lawyers needed to have a significant, not just a role, but a significant role in voir dire, is it's less about ferreting out who might be biased and who might. I think judges are more than capable of that. by and large, if they take their responsibility seriously. But the incentives to work really hard to dig and scratch and claw at the one fact that might matter to that are just so much stronger for the trial lawyer than they are for the judge, right? Like, you, as the trial lawyer, you care very much about winning. It's everything. That's why you're there. Your client did not hire you to play a part in some neutral system of justice. They hired you to win, right? So I just felt like the trial lawyers were just much more structurally motivated to get at the facts that mattered in assessing bias. So I could talk much more about voir dire, but that's a big one to me in trial practice that doesn't get as much attention as I think it deserves. Another reform that I was a big fan of as a judge that, you know, has taken some hold, but not enough in my view in courtrooms all over the place. Why don't jurors get more of an opportunity to ask questions? You know, I used to give my juries, the opportunity at the end of each witness examination to submit proposed questions of their own so that if they were trying to figure out what A or B or C meant, they'd have a chance to ask it, as opposed to waiting for another 3 months or 3 weeks until deliberations and hoping that they remembered that question or that another juror could answer it for them. That just seemed crazy to me. And so I would have juries propose questions. And I, as a judge, I would screen them to make sure there wasn't something crazy being introduced. But it was a remarkable it led to a remarkable sea change, not only in the quality of the examinations and their utility for the trier, which is what the, you know, these direction crosses aren't there for you as the trial lawyer, for me as the judge. They're there for the jury, right? And if it doesn't serve the jury's purposes, what are we doing? So that was another thing that mattered. I found really, really powerful.
When you allowed that, were jurors, did they tend to be active in participating in that? What kind of questions did you get? And were there questions that sometimes might have caused problems for you as a judge with?
Well, can I say, Ben, that every juror took advantage of that opportunity and really, no, that would be disingenuous. There were some jurors who were going to check out no matter what. But in almost every case I can remember, there were other jurors who took that opportunity very seriously. And here's the thing, you know, traditional trial in America, at least, is like the one place where we bring together a bunch of disinterested, underprepared people. And on top of everything else, we tell them to do what? To shut up. Don't talk to anybody at home. Don't talk to your fellow jurors until we get to the deliberations. We tell them to defer to the judge and the lawyer's wisdom and what questions are going to be asked. And at the same time, we tell them, your job is to get this right because you own the responsibility of assessing, you know, the facts that are presented. That's crazy. We would never do that in any other setting, right? It would be like telling a lecture hall full of college students or high school students in a classroom that for the next 3 months, they would be learning about every facet of AP calculus. But at no point in time will we allow you to ask a single question of the instructor for fear that somehow that might, you know, encourage you to form an impression of the subject matter prematurely. It's nuts. It's nuts. And so I just never understood the logic of it. Did on rare occasion, did a juror propose a question that was irrelevant or even prejudicial if responded to in a certain way? Yes. I suppose that happened less than 5 times in, you know, 30 jury trials, 30 or 35 jury trials. So it was a no-brainer to me. The other reform, by the way, that I thought made a big difference. I gave my trial lawyers the opportunity at the end of each week, when it was a multi-week trial, as these patent and trade secret cases tended to be, I would give them a chance to do mini closing arguments to say, hey, before we send these jurors home for 3 days or whatever, so that they can forget everything that you've just spent a week preparing, let me give you 30 minutes or even 15 minutes to just summarize and synthesize everything that we've just heard. And it made so much more logical sense to me if we just took a small step back and tried to remember what we were there for. We were there to get a good answer to a hard problem. We weren't there to like maintain control or authority as the judge. We weren't there to like, you know, sound good as trial lawyers. We were there to get a good result for the clients. And I just think that too often we lose sight of that in the way we design these exercises.
I love that. So you sound actually, this has always intrigued me here in California. You sound a lot like a California state judge.
I take that as a compliment.
It is absolutely a compliment. So 90% of the voir dire is done by the trial lawyers. And it's very typical in my trials that the jurors are permitted to ask questions. I think it actually gets the jury fully engaged. The ones that are going to be engaged get even more invested in the case, which I think is always good for the process. But I never understood why other federal court judges didn't see it your way, because it makes practical sense to do it the way you're suggesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not alone, or I was not alone. So I want to suggest I was the only one. And I think I never saw any instance in which a contrary view came from a place other than trying to get it right. So I think everybody's operating in good faith here. I just think that traditions are hard to let go of, and there is no more traditional place than federal district court. I think also for a lot of judges, or maybe not a lot, but too many judges, there's a fear of losing control, right? That if I let go of the reins of this thing, if I let the lawyer start doing more than I might otherwise want, if I start letting jurors get in on the act, my God, like, you know, what could happen next? And, you know, it is a little scary, and there are risks that you need to be, you know, mindful of. But I just, you know, once I did it a couple of times, I found out that, you know, the water's just fine. You just got to dip your toe in and try a few of these things once or twice before you jump in. And I'm still a long-term optimist that federal judges and judges all over the country will adopt some of these practices that are more common in the state courts, at least here in California. But it's a slow process, and I think there's still a long way to go before we get there.
We're going to take a break for 30 seconds to recognize our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
During our quick break, I want to remind you that our show today is being sponsored by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a case management program designed for trial law and personal injury law firms, all the way from smaller PI firms to the largest MDL and class action firms. It's the case management software we use at our office, and we love it. Our show also is sponsored by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full service digital marketing firm started by friends of the pod, Tyler and Micah, who have years of experience helping trial lawyers getting great results in their cases. And now they're turning that attention to digital marketing. So check them out at hypelegal.com. Our show today is sponsored by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the ultimate partner for helping trial lawyers pair with the right experts for their cases and working their cases up all the way from intake through verdict. So check them out at expertinstitute.com/elevate. ELAWVATE, and you will receive a 25% off discount on your first expert consult.
Paul, you were talking about an effective advocacy being argument by analogy. Before I ask my next question, I just want to let you know, you don't know this, but when you switched from Facebook to Coinbase, our mutual friend Alok Sharma, he called me up. He's like, dude, Paul just went to Coinbase. And I thought, wow, he's going into the crypto world. And the first thing I thought was, well, then this world must be legitimate. And that was the first time I actually started investing, not because I have any idea what crypto is even to this day, but because you entered that world. So argument by analogy, are you able to use that to help explain to the lay people here on this podcast what crypto is? Is it here to stay? And which ones are or are not?
Well, I don't have much of an opinion because I generally don't pay any attention to the market for different crypto assets and which assets, you know, have a long-term future and which don't. But I can explain a little bit about how crypto works. You know, the best analogy for what a, you know, what a cryptocurrency is to think about crypto as a network, and as like any network, there are different participants involved in attempting to, you know, make the system as a whole work and function. In crypto, the real innovation that came when Bitcoin was first announced to the world by Satoshi Nakamoto was this idea that the ledgers that are used in traditional finance to track who's paying whom and who owns what at any given moment on any given day could be put onto servers or computers all over the world and distributed so that we no longer had to rely upon a single source of authority like a clearinghouse or an exchange, but instead could trust that all sorts of people or entities scattered all over the world could manage these transactions and make sure that when someone said they owned this coin and wished to transfer it to that person, that they in fact were the rightful owner and that the person that they were seeking to transfer to was available on the network to receive it. So that's all that crypto is it takes a very ancient idea, which is that we want people to actually own the assets they say they own and be able to transfer them to people who are actually available to receive them, and just makes it a much more distributed global electronic means. And that's essentially how what crypto is in a nutshell.
Is it an asset?
It is. You can think of coins or tokens as assets, like gold, like silver, or seashells, if you want to go back to the most ancient analogy. Going back to those ancient times, we've always as humans looked for stores of value, things that signified that you had invested effort or labor or somebody else had, such that you could exchange that for things that you wanted, but that weren't directly tied to the labor or the effort that you were able to provide. And that's all that crypto is. It's really no more complicated than a distributed ledger of gold or seashells or whatever that are available to any person anywhere on the planet who has a smartphone and an internet connection.
And you work for a company called Coinbase?
I do. Yeah, Coinbase.
Can you explain what they do?
Yeah, so Coinbase is an exchange which allows people to buy, sell, and trade crypto assets anywhere in the world. So trading of these crypto assets is really the first and most popular use case. It's what's captured so much of the enthusiasm and energy that we've seen over the past year or two about crypto. And so Coinbase is a place for regular people to take a few dollars and convert it into a little bit of Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of the other assets that we list, and to begin to trade that crypto asset with other people, not just on Coinbase, but anywhere in the world who have an internet connection and which to either buy or sell or trade that same asset. Now, one of the more interesting and ultimately for me most compelling opportunities at Coinbase was that the trading of these assets was just the first phase. The promise we see in crypto is that there really is the potential for a crypto economy that supports not just trading or speculation, but rather payments, for example, so that people can use crypto to buy and sell real stuff like a pizza or dry cleaning or a Tesla, and then beyond that, all sorts of other financial products like credit products, borrowing and lending, and other things that people need in order to operate in the modern world. So that's sort of how we're thinking about this as we move ahead.
And then how did you decide to enter the worlds of cryptocurrency and join Coinbase? What intrigued you about this arena?
So I got my first exposure to crypto when I was at Facebook, when Facebook attempted to roll out its global stablecoin that it referred to at that time as Libra. And if you paid any attention to this world or watched Twitter, you saw that rollout did not go so well. It was met with a lot of hostility, both in the public, but also more importantly among legislators and policymakers all over the world, who, felt that the coin posed a threat to the global financial system. And so that was my introduction to crypto. And as you might imagine, my first impression was, God, that's the last thing I want to spend the next 5 or 10 years of my career working on. But it whetted my appetite to learn more about some of the foundations of crypto, to read the Satoshi white paper, which was really the first layperson's explanation for how this system could work. And as I went down what a lot of people refer to as the crypto rabbit hole, I became more and more intrigued by the promise of this thing. And I came to understand that this wasn't just a bunch of anarchists looking to thwart the sovereignty of nations with an alternative monetary system, that this was actually a very interesting, thoughtful, compelling technology that could solve a lot of problems with our current financial system that regular people deal with every day. And once I got bitten by that bug, when I was offered the opportunity to come lead the legal compliance and other functions of the company, I just couldn't say no. And so here I am.
What are some of the problems that everyday people deal with that cryptocurrencies can potentially solve?
Yeah. So there are a number of them, but I'll give you one example that's most compelling to me. And that is the problem of cross-border remittances, right? So if you are a worker in one country who hails from another country and you wish to send home a portion of your paycheck to support your family, today in 2021, you have to run an incredible gauntlet of money transfer, middle firms, wire payments, transaction fees, just to get the dollar you might earn here in the United States back to your family in India or the Philippines or any other country. And that dollar doesn't stay a dollar. It turns into something much less because of all the intermediaries that have to touch that payment in order to transfer value. Crypto offers the potential to eliminate all of that, so that if I have a part of a Bitcoin that I've earned here in the United States for my day's work, I can, in an instant, without any middle person, any intermediary, and instantly, I can transfer that, you know, that day's wage to my mother or to my child or to whomever else, anywhere around the world, and to do so without any delay. That's a very powerful use case that certainly speaks to, you know, I think the problem we have with the current financial system, which is that there are a lot of layers that are involved in between one person and another, and each of those layers wants their cut. And we think there's a way to eliminate, if not all of it, much of it, in a way that will, in order to regular people's benefit.
I would assume in your work in the legal departments at Facebook and now at Coinbase, you are obviously not doing all of the legal work yourself, but are managing teams of lawyers and large law firms. And
a lot of small ones too. I want to put in a plug for the boutiques and sole practitioners that we work with who do amazing work. They don't often get enough attention.
Yeah, I bet. You probably find some of the best lawyers in those locations. But what are you looking for when you're trying to find counsel to work for companies like this?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very fair question. I think that for me, the most important quality I look for in any outside counsel is the ability to understand the fundamental problem we're trying to solve, and they're not just willingness, but eagerness to scope the solution to that problem. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, on rare occasions, you have to take a $500 million class action to trial. And if that's the case, then you need to assemble the armies and deploy the weaponry in order to prevail in that matter. And often those are massive in scale. But I'm just as often, and I say I in a very selfish sense, I have an incredible team of people who, as you allude to, Ben, do the lion's share, almost all of the great work that we do at this company every day. And so what that team is looking for, the team that I lead, in most instances, however, is an answer to a question. Should we include this feature in the next version of the product? Do we launch in Slovenia when we face some risk of an enforcement action by some regulator in that jurisdiction? Do we run the risk of violating someone else's trade secret property rights when we hire a group of engineers from that company and despite our best efforts, you know, come to discover that they may have inadvertently brought over certain documents, things like that? I'm looking for lawyers who want to solve the problem as opposed to fit my question into some preconceived legal framework and think of these issues as topics for summary judgment or for closing argument, as opposed to a business problem that just needs an answer.
I want to change topics just a little bit because I want to cover at least two other areas with you, Paul, if not more. I could talk to you for days, by the way.
It's fun.
It is fun. So one of the things that I'd be remiss not to ask about this, just given your career trajectory, you were president of the South Asian Bar Association in Northern California and the National South Asian Bar Association. What do you think, and have you ever experienced any situation where being South Asian, having a darker complexion, anything like that, was a barrier for you? And then how did you deal with it, or how did you take advantage of that situation, whichever it was?
Well, just to take a step back, Rahul, you know, to answer your question, it's important to understand or explain sort of where I came from. You know, I am the child of immigrants to this country. My parents came from India in the 1960s. I grew up in a very small town in Northeast Ohio in the 1970s, a town that had probably, 5,000 people at its peak. And so, you know, there were not a lot of folks like me in my hometown and where I went to grade school, middle school, and high school. And so I would be disingenuous if I didn't acknowledge that, you know, over the course of that, you know, that experience as a kid, I didn't, you know, hear some ugly things and experience some, you know, painful events as a result of the fact that my family and I were different. We wore turbans and wore saris. We did not necessarily fit into the, you know, classic image of small town Ohio life. That said, I had a wonderful childhood in that community. And, one of the things I was really grateful for, especially with the, you know, looking back on it, was that I learned that the world could be an unfair place, you know, sometimes an ugly place, but at the end of the day, other than your family, maybe a few close friends, nobody was going to care about, the aftermath of that for you or for me or for anybody else more than you or I would. In other words, at the end of the day, we have to take care of ourselves, or else, you know, we're going to be sorely disappointed in almost every instance. So, you know, that was the mentality I had going through, you know, my childhood and when I went off to college and law school after that. So in the practice, when on rare occasion, you know, I came across an ignorant judge or an opposing counsel who frankly lacked class, you know, I learned that the problem, or I sort of had the attitude that the problem ultimately was theirs, not mine. And there were many instances where, you know, it was important for me to be generous in understanding that someone's comment or observation wasn't coming from a place of ugliness per se, but just ignorance. I'll give you one quick example. One of the most difficult, I mentioned I did lose at trial as a trial lawyer, and so it's important to acknowledge that. One of the most difficult losses I had was in a patent case I tried in East Texas, in a small town called Marshall, which at least in the early 2000s was trying a lot of patent cases for interesting reasons. And, you know, as I'm walking out with my team, because these cases aren't generally tried by one lawyer, they're tried by a team of lawyers, I'm standing in the parking lot having, you know, just heard that my client had been socked with a 9-figure verdict. Not your best day in most trial lawyers' lives, right? Anyway, long story short, as I'm literally on the verge of tears, as I'm loading up the banker's boxes into the rental car, one of the jurors comes running across the parking lot to find me. And she sees that I'm over there in the corner of the lot. She grabs me by the arm. She looks me in the eye and she says, you know, I bet you're feeling really bad about what just happened in there, but I want you to know something. If I ever get into trouble and need to hire a lawyer, or a friend of mine needs to hire a lawyer, I'm going to tell that friend, you go and hire that Mr. Sanchez. He's the best trial lawyer I ever saw. You know, so she thought I was Mexican American or Hispanic or whatever. And that's, you know, I could have taken offense to that at that moment. And instead I said, well, you know what, ma'am, thank you. I hope you'll tell them Paul Sanchez, you know, is always there for you. And I let it go at that. So you have to try to assess in each circumstance whether someone's truly bigoted and coming from a place of hate, or, you know, they're just doing the best they can. And that was that's the model I've always had in my head. And, you know, it served me reasonably well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Let's talk about I'm not saying you're retiring or anything, Paul.
It's not that
you're the end of your career.
My CEO and my board might be listening to this podcast, so I'm definitely not retiring.
But given your life experiences so far, and you've had a lot of them, and you've had an amazing set of careers, each and every one of them would be amazing in and of itself. What type of advice would you give to young lawyers or those that are starting in the profession, thinking about going to law school, about good practices and what the future holds for them?
So the first piece of advice I would share to anybody even thinking about the law, let alone somebody who's made a commitment to the law, is that being a lawyer, it's not just a privilege and an honor. It's tons of fun. Like, I love it. I love what I do every day. I love being around other lawyers. I especially love trial lawyers. It's a unique breed. We're not for everybody, right? But it's just been, you know, an incredible opportunity for me to meet some of the most fun, interesting, bright, talented people I could ever have imagined. So I think law, and especially trial law, really is still one of the greatest opportunities anyone could pursue in their careers. So I'm a long-term optimist when it comes to the practice of law, and especially trial law. I think for a lot of young lawyers, and I should say newer lawyers, because more and more people are entering law as a second or even third career, you know, the first few years can be dispiriting and even, you know, disheartening. And I get that. You know, I was a junior associate going through boxes of documents back when paper was how you reviewed documents. I've been in that courtroom when the partner took my perfectly crafted direct examination and claimed it as his own and left me to pick up the pencils and the staplers when the end of the day came. I've been there. I know what that's like. And what I want to share to any newer lawyers out there listening to this is that the practice of law just gets better and better with each passing day. You know, as much fun as I enjoyed in the earliest parts of my career, getting to do that first deposition, submitting my first brief to the Court of Appeals with my name on it, I've never had more fun practicing law than doing what I'm doing now. And that's in large part because I'm working for a super interesting company in a very interesting industry. But it's largely because law is one of the few careers where you become more valuable with time. You know, your experience as it informs your judgment is an asset, not a liability. And that's not true in a lot of other professions. And so hang in there, I guess, is the real piece of advice or encouragement I would share, because I just think back to all those moments when I got frustrated and God forbid I had indulged in it and quit the law and decided to do something else, because I would have missed everything that followed. And everything that follows has just been just a gift, and I'm grateful for it. So I hope, and I know that that will be most people's experiences if they just hang in there a little bit longer.
What was going to be the plan B path if you quit early?
Well, like a lot of good Indian boys, I thought about, and girls, I thought about medicine. I actually took, I actually was admitted to medical school. And so, I broke my mom and dad's heart when I turned that down. But they eventually forgave me, I think. And so I suppose medicine would have been that plan B. So it would not have been sitting on a beach somewhere. It would have been studying organic chemistry and anatomy and all of that.
It's so nice to hear your positive view of what your career has been in practicing law. And I agree with you. I've met a lot of great people through my practice of law and being a trial lawyer. And I really gravitate toward and love the people who do this for some reason, such as Raul. One reason we're doing this show is because we just enjoy talking and meeting with people like you. And it can be very different from people who practice law in other ways and really do seem to have more of a cynical or, unpleasant experience. So, but it's just so great to hear that. And you've done such incredible work throughout your career and yet still have such a positive view of it. It's nice to hear.
Well, it's an honor to be able to do this work. And I will say this, I think that, trial work especially, but law more generally, it offers a very interesting insight into the human psyche, right? You really get to see a lot and learn a lot about human nature that you wouldn't otherwise when you're thinking about how to hook that witness on one admission that you need in order to crater the other side's case, or when you're trying to read that judge and figure out, is she just mad at my case or my client, or is she actually mad at me? You know, all the little calculations you have to undergo or undertake in this work, I just think, you know, gives you a window into the human soul that is hard to beat and hard to replace. So yeah, I love it. And I hope to see, you know, the next generation of trial lawyers, you know, take things even further from here.
We do too. Hey, Paul, thank you so much for joining us on the Elevate podcast.
Yeah, thank you. You were terrific.
It's my pleasure, guys.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.